tracking your cell phone data during a pandemic, great for contact tracing, not so great for privacy.
You as a citizen need to trust your government in that they're not going to misuse your data.
Also today, the global economy on the ropes. In Africa, many nations were deeply indebted to international banks before the coronavirus. Some global leaders now say, erase that debt.
We shouldn't be penalizing countries for what they did not cause. Only the living can pay back debt.
And flexing your kitchen skills during the lockdown, but are you ready to take on an ancient Japanese recipe for cheese?
Cooking it slowly, 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 stirring for an hour, 2 hours. It took me about 5 hours, actually.
The best things in life take time. Those stories and more today on The World. In a pandemic, U.S. policies continue to have a far-reaching impact on our neighbors and foreign nationals living in the U.S. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, is continuing to deport unauthorized immigrants from the U.S. One of the ways they do this is through so-called deportation flights.
ICE Air is the agency's charter airline. The flights take people living in the U.S. illegally out of the country.
An obscure division of ICE operates hundreds of these flights each year to remove immigrants.
It's a trip where the passengers can't choose window or aisle, and the only way to fly is coach.
But Guatemala is now saying no more flights. This announcement came after dozens of deportees tested positive for COVID-19, according to Guatemalan officials. The World's Jorge Valencia has been following the story. So Guatemala says it's suspending deportation flights from the U.S., Jorge. What does that mean exactly?
Well, what that means is that this is now the third time that the Guatemalan government has told the United States we will no longer be receiving flights of deportees. And the White House has already been proactive about this. They have already threatened with retaliation Guatemala, or really any government that refuses to accept flights full of people that are being deported from the United States.
So let's back up a sec, because there have already been some flights with deportees who tested positive. How many are we talking about?
It appears to be under dispute. So I want to draw your attention to flights that came on Monday, one from El Paso, Texas, and one from Alexandria, Louisiana, to Guatemala. Now, there were some reports from anonymous government sources of people who were carrying the virus, and some of the numbers were quite large. Carlos Sandoval is the spokesperson for Guatemala's presidency. I just want you to hear what he has to say.
Es importante mencionar que Guatemala se encuentra trabajando junto a las autoridades de los Estados Unidos de América.
Sandoval is saying that there are now going to be tests again, and they're being done by the Centers for Disease Control. So the U.S. is conducting tests, and then also Guatemala's government is conducting tests in Guatemalan labs. So it appears that now the United States has stepped in and wants to basically have their own look about whether or not people after they arrived to Guatemala were carrying the virus.
And what is the situation with COVID-19 in Guatemala? Is the country equipped to deal with a larger outbreak?
Well, Guatemala's president has been proactive about this. He has put in place temporary hospitals in different parts of the country so that people who might be carrying the virus can be treated in those facilities. He has also set up places where people who are being deported from the United States can be isolated for 2 weeks after they arrive from the United States. In fact, there was a case that happened earlier this week in a community where there were 60 people who were deported. They were being transported to be quarantined in that place. But the response from the community was quite strong. In fact, there were attempts to set the place on fire. So the following day, President Alejandro Yamate had to go on national television. Here's what he said.
Tenemos que comprender que no es atacando a los que están retornando.
So the president is saying, you are not fixing anything by setting the place on fire. And now this is creating some sort of social unrest in Guatemala. I mean, it's good to remember that when people are forcefully removed from the United States, taken to Guatemala, the stigma of having been in detention in the United States comes with them to Guatemala. Even before this, like, people wouldn't want to publicly share with their neighbors, with their friends, that they had just been deported. And so now this is interacting with the coronavirus and the fact that there are people who are being transported who are carrying this virus. And this could possibly be the case not just in Guatemala, but in other countries. My colleague Monica Campbell reported earlier this week that there are continuing to be flights to places like Haiti, Dominican Republic, and Guatemala.
The World's Jorge Valencia, thanks very much for continuing to watch this troubling story.
Thank you, Marco.
go to a hospital in Detroit, and there's a good chance you'll be seen by a nurse who's Canadian. Many nurses in Ontario cross the border every day to work in the U.S. Some even work in multiple hospitals on both sides of the border. But now coronavirus could change that. To try to slow the spread of the virus, Canadian officials are telling nurses, pick a side. Dr. Wajid Ahmed is the chief medical officer in Windsor, Essex County, Ontario.
We practically are one community when you're looking at Windsor and Detroit. A significant number of people cross every day, close to 6,000 people who cross border and work in Michigan, close to 1,600 are healthcare workers who are going there and working there. What we have seen recently is a significant increase in the number of cases in Michigan side. In Ontario side, the increase was not as significant. But when we are talking about healthcare workers, they don't have any boundaries. They're working there, they're working here. So we did feel that there has to be a better measure to contain the virus as much as possible.
Would you say hospitals in Michigan are pretty dependent on nurses from Canada?
I would say so, because I know some of the hospitals, they have a significant proportion of their workforce that are from Canada, and they need those workers to keep the operations going. And without these workers, they won't be able to operate the way they normally do. And this is not even a normal time. So it would be very difficult for them to maintain operations.
So what restrictions are being put on these nurses currently, and what restrictions do you think should be put in place?
What is happening in the Canadian side is a healthcare worker needs to restrict their work to one facility and not work in multiple facilities. If you are coming back and you're still working in Michigan, knowing that your risk is high, when you're returning to Canada, the moment you enter Canada, you basically go into the self-isolation mode. So you're coming straight to your home. You're not going to any grocery store or doing any of the work that you need to do. And you are staying at home and not meeting anyone and follow everything that you should. So we are hoping that these measures, if followed appropriately, they won't be spreading it to our community.
So if you were in charge, doctor, would you make it so that nurses would just stop going to the U.S. altogether?
If in my community the needs are, I need those nurses, then probably I would say, yes, we need those nurses right now because we have a shortage of nurses and we are critically low in nursing supplies. Right now that's not the situation. So we feel that, yeah, we are basically just doing our part as neighbors. They need our support. Can we provide them with our support? Yes, we can. So might as well do it. And if that changes, then that's a different conversation altogether. Right now, we haven't seen that at this time.
So as you know, earlier this month, President Trump banned the export of N95 masks to Canada. And then Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Canada would not issue any retaliatory measures in response. And he cited the nurses in Ontario as an example of how close the U.S. and Canada are intertwined. Would restrictions on nurses suddenly change that and raise tensions, do you think?
I don't think so. I think as Canadians, we do have a better understanding of how we should support not only ourselves, but a global fight against this COVID pandemic. And we will continue to do our part, continue to support our neighbors, continue to support the rest of the world as much as possible, up to our capacity. And I think that's a great thing that being a Canadian means, and supporting others.
Dr. Wajid Ahmed is the chief medical officer in Windsor, Essex County, Ontario. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
The coronavirus pandemic has people stranded everywhere. You can't get out, can't get in, can't get home. For Indian nationals living in the U.S., things are particularly challenging. That's because India is under total lockdown. But as the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, Indian Americans are stepping up to help.
Just before global travel mostly stopped and India went into lockdown, Ujjwala Tate's visa to work at a hotel in Florida expired. Now she's stranded, alone, in the U.S., far from her family and without a job.
But the hotel where I was working, they gave us accommodation where I'm living.
With her money dwindling, Date is scared.
The grocery shops are like 10, 20 miles away, and we don't have any local transportation. In the building, I have American family who knows me very well, because sometimes they provide me food.
What's scariest is that she doesn't know when this will end.
No choice what to do. I have to survive.
We can't go back to our home country.
Thousands of Indian nationals on visas, like Date, are stuck in the U.S., including many students. Sudhanshu Kashyap is executive director of the North American Association of Indian Students.
All stakeholders involved, the government, the diplomatic missions, the students, and the community, I don't think they understood the scope of how much this lockdown would affect them.
He says many of the Indian students in the U.S. were on scholarships. Within a few days, a lot lost their jobs. Some didn't have enough money to eat. Others were evicted. Their families in India begged the Indian government to arrange transportation home. Eventually, Indian officials responded that they just couldn't provide flights for so many people.
In terms of the scope and the logistics, it was an obvious no, that it isn't possible. But even that answer, even that simple no took almost 4, 5, 6 days, which created somewhat of a confusion and a hysteria among the students because they just didn't have a definite answer.
Hello, everyone. Hope you're all doing well. Thank you once again for joining us today. We have with us Ambassador Santu, who's the ambassador of India to the United States.
A few days ago, the Indian ambassador to the U.S., Duranjit Singh Sandhu, sat down to take urgent questions directly from students over Instagram. He told them any travel would invite trouble. It would expose them to possible infection and could also be harmful for their families in India when they arrived home.
You are in the United States of America. Therefore, there is nothing to panic. My strong advice to you is stay put where you are. We are in touch with you. You have problems, please come to us and we will help you out.
Indian officials created a 24/7 hotline. They enlisted the help of Indian hotel owners across the country to house people who are stranded. One of those hotel owners is KP Patel, an American-born son of Gujarati Indian immigrants.
My dad came over from India, with the story, right? Had nothing in his pocket. Told himself up, but it is India that is our motherland.
So Patel says it was his duty to help fellow Indians. He's reserved half of his rooms in Santa Cruz, California, for local Indian students who were displaced from their university housing or were staying in places that put them at risk.
For example, I took in 3 students just over the last few days, and they were in an unsafe environment where 6, 7 kids staying in one apartment, 2 or 3 students didn't feel safe being there. I asked them to come stay with me for a few weeks.
Now each student has their own room. Patel's working with Meals on Wheels to get them food. He says he'll house them for as long as this emergency lasts. Despite efforts by people like Patel and assurances from the Indian ambassador, Sudhanshu Kashyap of the North American Association of Indian Students remains worried. He says it's hard to reach such a large, spread-out population so quickly. Some Indians affected don't even have cell phones.
I think many people are falling through the cracks.
There's also a lot of misinformation going around and people running scams. And in the back of Kashyap's mind is the question of what happens when this is all over. Will thousands of Indians pack flights to return home? What will happen then?
Where are you going to quarantine these? You already have a lack of places where you can do so. Which is a true headache. You have a lack of tests that are taking place. So how are we going to mediate that?
He says now that the Indian government understands the magnitude of the problem and the sheer number of people impacted, hopefully they're trying to plan ahead and answer those questions. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The coronavirus is a threat to refugee camps everywhere. Often sanitary conditions are terrible. Social distancing is almost impossible. Today, The World's Shirin Jafari brings us a story about 2 camps in northeastern Syria, home not just to refugees, but also a group of people suspected of having ties to the Islamic State. Some of them come from Western countries that have refused to take them back.
5 years ago, on a summer day, Michelle said goodbye to her sister.
When I hugged her, it didn't feel like I was going to hug her for the last time.
Michelle, who asked that I only use her first name, says her sister was going through a rough patch at the time. She'd grown up in a Christian family in Canada, but converted to Islam. She'd gone through several unsuccessful marriages and was struggling with her mental health, Michelle says.
And I could tell she was kind of cycling, like she was going to do something because things weren't going so well for her. I had some concerns about her, like, when she did leave, but I thought, well, okay, maybe this will do her some good.
Michelle's sister told her she found a job in Austria. She had a friend there, so it wasn't completely out of the blue. But what her family didn't know at the time was that she had secretly married a man online. He was a member of the Islamic State, and she was going to join him in Syria.
And then she did go to Austria, and she did send some pictures. And then I just didn't hear anything from her.
The next time Michelle and her family heard about her sister was from the Canadian intelligence services. They told them she was in Raqqa, the capital of the so-called Islamic State Caliphate in Syria. Michelle couldn't believe it.
What could I have done differently, and how did it ever get to be to this extent?
Between 2014 and 2016, hundreds of Westerners traveled to Syria. Among them, young women from Europe, Canada, and the US who got married and had children there. By 2017, the US-led coalition and local forces had driven out ISIS from most of its territory. Islamic State fighters were either killed or taken to prisons. But many of the women and children were sent to camps in Kurdish-held territory in northern Syria. Al-Hol and Roj are two of the biggest camps. Elizabeth Surkov is with the Foreign Policy Research Institute.
Those who are still at the camp are overwhelmingly women and children and are not suspected of carrying out any activities on behalf of ISIS. And if they are suspected, if such information reaches the Kurdish authorities, then they are arrested.
Surkov researches Syria and Iraq and has visited the camps. She's also in contact with some of the women there. She says the conditions were bad even before the coronavirus pandemic.
There are almost on a daily basis children dying in the camp of preventable diseases, particularly during the winter.
Now local doctors tell her it's a humanitarian disaster in slow motion.
And they expect that once the pandemic hits the area, it will go through the camp very, very quickly.
Sonia Kush, Syria director for Save the Children, says crowded conditions will make it impossible to prevent the spread of the virus.
The population of Al-Hol camp is 4 times the density of New York City. So the idea that all these social distancing measures can be easily put in place is just not realistic.
There are roughly 11,000 foreign women and children at Al-Hol camp alone, says Kush. The pandemic, she says, has made it difficult to get daily necessities to them. Borders are closed, airports have shut down, and aid workers themselves have to take precautions to prevent the spread of the disease. At the same time, the families associated with the Islamic State face stigma back home. Elizabeth Surkov again.
Some countries are not interested in having any children back or anyone from the camp, no matter their age, due to political considerations, essentially.
Some countries have revoked citizenship of the camp's residents, so they can't go back. At the same time, the US, UK, and Germany have repatriated a few of them, mostly children. An outlier so far is Canada.
At the moment, we have 45 Canadians in Al-Hol, Camp Roj, and the prisons in northeast Syria. 27 of these Canadians are children.
Alexandra Bain is the director of Families Against Violent Extremism.
We work with families of mostly Canadians who have had someone, son, daughter, relative, who has caught up in violent extremism.
Her organization wants the Canadian government to bring back all its citizens, but especially the children in these camps.
I think we owe it to ourselves to make sure that Canadian citizenship means something. People have fought wars before. There have been camp followers before. We're big enough to do this.
The Canadian Security Intelligence Service didn't respond to my questions about repatriation of Canadian citizens. Michelle, whose sister is in one of the camps in northern Syria, says she worries about her condition every day. Her sister also has 3 children.
It's not humane to keep somebody captive without letting them know when they can get out or give them access to legal help.
Michelle says the pandemic makes all of this more difficult. Still, she's hopeful that one day she can hug her sister again. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Many of us are feeling the sports void. For me, March Madness, that never happened. Next year, Well, sports fans across the world are feeling the loss of every game, ritual, chant, so much so that ESPN is airing professional athletes playing themselves in video games.
And here is Lopez.
You'll have to shoot it.
Outside Matthews. Back to Giannis.
Please.
In Belarus, though, some real stadiums are open for business. The Belarusian Premier League is continuing to play soccer, though most local fans of reigning champion Dynamo Brest are choosing to stay away. The bleachers are pretty empty, but not entirely. The team is selling virtual tickets. Yeah, what does that mean? Buy a virtual ticket, the team will post a photo of your face on a mannequin sitting in the stands. And if soccer isn't your thing in Belarus, markets, schools, restaurants, and churches are also open. No word on whether mannequins with a picture of your face are appearing in the church pews yet. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko continues to dismiss concerns about the coronavirus outbreak. Last month he said, the scariest epidemic in the world is panic.
Why am I behaving this way? Because I'm absolutely certain that we will suffer more from panic than the virus. That's what worries me the most.
President Lukashenko demonstrated his confidence by lacing up and playing in a hockey game with a full crowd of cheering fans. After the game, Lukashenko said a hockey rink is the best place to be right now.
It's better to die standing than to live on your knees. There are no viruses here. You haven't noticed any of them flying around, have you? I don't see them either. This is a refrigerator. It's the best thing for your health, this fridge. It's an antiviral drug, the real thing.
Belarus is a country of roughly 10 million people. It has about 5,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. 42 people have died. News headlines are next. You're listening to The World. Staying active is critical for physical and mental health. Under quarantine, it's hard. Athletes have to get creative, like the Dutch Olympian who trains in an inflatable kiddie pool.
I have an elastic resistant band, and then I put that to a tree, and then actually I stay in one place in the pool.
Doing whatever it takes to stay active, that's coming up here on The World. In times of peril, it seems many rivals are laying down their arms, corporate rivals, that is. Google and Apple are working together, for example, to improve technology to do what's known as contact tracing, tracking down and alerting people who might have come in contact with someone who's tested positive for COVID-19. The World's Lydia Emanuelidou reports on what this means for privacy and for the digital tools governments are already using.
Singapore, South Korea, Germany, France. Those are just some of the countries using or developing smartphone apps to do contact tracing. The apps are all a little different, but generally speaking, they work something like this. Using Bluetooth technology, they log when people and their phones cross paths. If a person tests positive for the virus and they enter it into the app, people they've come in contact with are notified without revealing the carrier's identity. Experts say apps like these can help in the fight against COVID-19, but there's a problem. Different phones made by different companies can't necessarily communicate with each other. That's where Google and Apple come in. Normally, they're fierce competitors. But last week, they announced they're joining forces to build a platform that governments and developers can use to make COVID-19 tracking apps function better.
Now, this is quite significant because most of the software that help runs phones are either owned by Apple on iPhone or Google on Android.
Estelle Massé is with the NGO Access Now. She's based in Brussels. She says this unprecedented partnership could make contact tracing easier and more effective. But she has lots of questions about who will be allowed to tap into these new functions.
We need to have more clarity on the guidelines that both Google and Apple will be using in deciding which government can have access to the platform. Because the reality is that at the moment, there is a lot of differences in the apps that are being put forward.
Some of the apps have privacy safeguards, she says, and others do not. Apple and Google haven't said what governments or groups they're working with at the moment. They have said that as part of this joint effort, they're making user security and privacy a priority. Ali Funk is with Freedom House, a watchdog organization based in the U.S.
Google and Apple have recently said that they'll stop this program once the pandemic's brought under control. And that's a great promise, and we need to ensure that would happen.
Funk will be closely watching how Google and Apple deal with privacy issues as they try to make digital contact tracing more effective. But she says there's a lot the tech giants can't control, including how people feel about opting into government-run tracking programs.
Taiwan, I think, is a really interesting example because there is a lot more trust in the government and there's a lot of citizen participation in the creation and deployment of these apps because it comes down to you as a citizen need to trust your government in that they're not going to misuse your data.
But there's another critical step before people can hand over their data.
The elephant in the room is that these programs all come down to mass testing. And in the U.S., we know this has been a massive issue.
Without the ability to widely test whether people have the coronavirus, there's no way to accurately report where it's spreading. And Funk says no apps and no tech partnerships, however unprecedented, can fill that gap. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
More testing and contact tracing will be critical to getting the country moving again. We're not there yet. Still, President Trump wants Americans to go back to work in phases. Will that approach still protect public health? Mark Lipsitch is an epidemiologist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. So the president last night announced a three-phase plan to open the country for business, so to speak. It's a plan that relies on regional and local conditions and expertise. What do you make of that approach?
There are components of it that are really good. The first component being that it's phased, and so it's not trying to reopen everything at once, which would be not safe. The second is that it does call for using data to guide it. And the third is that the first stage is a relatively conservative, cautious level of reopening. So those are all good features. I'm more than a little concerned about some other features of it. For example, there is no mention anywhere in the materials I read of a plan for what happens if we make a mistake, what happens if we open up too much and start to get a resurgence. It's a sort of sunny projection of here's how we're going to start turning all the lights back on again without any kind of consideration of how we would know if we had gone too far.
As far as letting the data guide the determination for turning the lights back on, as you say, one of the criticisms is that the plan doesn't really describe how to acquire that solid data. Testing would provide that data, and isn't testing still our Achilles heel in the U.S.?
Indeed. I think both that we are handicapped by our lack of good testing, both serological and virological testing, a continuing problem that's been exacerbated by federal delays. And the second piece is that the idea of 2 weeks of declining cases as a trigger, that's not good enough, in part because the reporting delays for cases are so long, due again to testing limitations, among other problems, that we're just beginning to learn really what happened 2 weeks ago because the case reports are sort of stabilizing. But last week's cases are still, the numbers are still going up because we're getting more reports in. So 2 weeks is just not enough for that reason, and also because we need to get cases down, not just sort of flattening, but really a lot down from the levels that we consider dangerous in order to think that we can afford to allow a little bit more spread.
So every country is trying to weigh the tension between protecting public health and people making a living. Are other countries also seeing 2 weeks as a gold standard of sorts, and why or why not?
I mean, I think, in fact, what's going to happen is there are going to be various experiments around the world and probably around the country with opening up at different phases and opening up to different degrees. It's really important to understand that returning to normal, real normal, while we still have a majority of the population susceptible, is not an option. It may be for a period of time, but if there are infectious people and the majority of the population is still susceptible, as it is probably in virtually every place in the world, when you return to normal levels of social activity, there is going to be more transmission and the number of cases is going to grow. And one of the things that's been difficult is to get clear in people's minds that it's not the peak. There's not one peak to an epidemic. There's potentially multiple peaks, and those occur when you keep most of the population susceptible by successful control and then let down that control. So this is a long-term issue. It's not a single shot and we're done.
Mark Lipsitch is an epidemiologist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and director of their Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you.
No country can hide from the economic toll caused by the pandemic. Different countries, different problems, different solutions. Many African nations are already saddled with heavy debt. As we hear now from the world's Halima Gikandi, African and other world leaders are brainstorming creative solutions to avoid an economic catastrophe.
While African countries were among the last to be hit by the coronavirus pandemic, their economies will not be spared. The World Bank projects that the coronavirus could push the whole continent into its first recession in 25 years. Cesar Calderon is a lead economist at the World Bank's Africa region. He says the outbreak is already hurting some of the continent's most important industries.
Countries that are more dependent on tourism are taking a big hit. So you can think about Botswana or Kenya, Mauritius, South Africa.
Companies are laying off workers and their supply chains have been disrupted. Calderon says African countries face unique obstacles.
In the case of Africa, of course, there's the challenge of the informal sector being the main source of employment.
Informal meaning people don't earn regular salaries. They work day to day and get paid a daily wage. Few of these workers have the option to work from home. According to Calderon, many countries have already introduced emergency measures to help those informal workers. In Nigeria, for example, the government is expanding a cash transfer program to help the country's poorest communities. Catherine Kikwonu is a cassava farmer in southern Nigeria who recently received one of those cash payments and was featured in a video posted by the Nigerian government.
Too much.
The money will help me keep my business going, she says. Kenya has also pledged to send cash directly to people in the poorest communities using mobile phones. But these type of relief programs can be expensive. Calderon says African countries are worse off this time because of huge debt burdens.
Back in 2008, when the global financial crisis started, many countries in the region had a healthy fiscal balance. They have higher growth rates.
Many African countries are saddled with massive debt obligations. They owe money to regional and international financial institutions, as well as other governments, which means they have less money in the bank right now to spend on their coronavirus response. Akinwumi Adesina is the president of the African Development Bank in Abidjan, Côte d'Ivoire. The bank has pledged $10 billion to African countries. It has also deferred debt payments for private companies that owe the bank. The Adesina said at a news conference recently that African countries need debt relief too.
It is time for all of us to work together globally to reprofile debt payments by African countries.
Calls for a complete moratorium on debt payments are coming from outside of Africa as well.
Nous devons aussi savoir aider nos voisins d'Afrique.
On Monday, French President Emmanuel Macron said the world should help African countries by, quote, massively canceling their debts. Adesina of the African Development Bank says in addition to debt relief, credit agencies should not downgrade countries that are hurting because of the coronavirus.
We shouldn't be penalizing countries for what they did not cause. Now, if this trend continues, I think that only the living can pay back debt.
In other words, African countries need to focus their financial resources on saving lives now during this pandemic. The IMF and World Bank have chimed in too. They're calling on wealthy countries to suspend debt payments owed to them by developing ones. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
These days, my version of staying active is taking the dog out for a walk. But pro athletes need a lot more than that to stay in shape. The world's Bianca Hillier reports.
We have another world champion ready to come out for France.
When Alexandre Recchia steps onto the mat, the karate world pays attention.
An absolute fantastic athlete.
Alexandre Recchia is a five-time karate world champion who's chasing her biggest podium yet, winning gold for France at the Tokyo Olympics.
This is my drug, so I really need to do sports all day to be confident, to be healthy, to be good.
Under quarantine, Rekia's dedication remains the same, though her training setup is entirely different than usual.
This is the difference. I'm training at home by myself and without partner. My boyfriend don't really love karate, so he builds me kind of partner with a lamp.
Yeah, a lamp. Rekia's boyfriend filled a flower pot with pebbles, stuck a standing lamp inside, and attached cushions at head height and chest height. It's not exactly the type of equipment a world-class athlete is used to, but it's kickable and punchable, so it works.
Yeah, really, really. I trained without since 4 weeks, and it is really perfect.
Check social media, and you'll find that Rekia is just one of the many pro athletes around the world who have come up with creative ways to keep training at home. American figure skater Jason Brown doesn't have an ice rink in his backyard, so he's skipping rope while wearing his ice skates.
Forward and back, side to side.
Athletes are also replacing dumbbells with their children and putting toddlers on their backs during push-ups, like Norwegian wrestler Stig Andre Berge. Dutch Olympic swimmer Sharon van Ruindal delayed at-home workouts for as long as possible. She tried to train at a local beach, but
the police was waiting for me when I went out of the water.
After a similarly unsuccessful swim at a nearby lake, Van Ruindal resorted to her own backyard and an inflatable kiddie pool.
Like 2 meters, so I just fit in. And I have an elastic resistant band, and then I put that to a tree. And then actually I stay in one place in the pool, so I can swim 1 hour nonstop, going nowhere.
Professional athletes have a more strict regimen than the rest of us. But French karate champion Alexandra Rekia says they battle the same obstacles as everyone else.
The difficulty is to stay motivated. It is so very important to stay in good health. And we cannot stay in good health if we stay in the sofa.
To get off the sofa, Rekia suggests enlisting people you're quarantining with or finding a virtual training partner.
If you are alone, please go in Instagram, go in Facebook, and you can see every day influencers give advice and motivate you to do some sports. Move your body and move your mind.
We're not all trying to win a gold medal or break a world record, but with a little creativity, we can break a sweat without leaving home. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Homemade sourdough bread, that is so 10 days ago. Lockdowns around the globe have pushed people's culinary creativity much further, and I mean serious creativity. In Japan, they're going old school, as in a cheese recipe that's over 1,000 years old. It's called so. Makiko Ito is a cookbook author who's been documenting this trend and making so herself.
It tastes really like concentrated milk. I mean, that's the only thing I can compare it to. But it's slightly sweet from the inherent sweetness of the milk, maybe. The closest thing that's not cheese that I would compare it to would be a fudge, except no sugar added.
A lot of people make yogurt in their kitchens, but making cheese, how do you do this at home?
Everyone that is trying this recipe, including myself, is just cooking it slowly over a low heat until the moisture evaporates and it forms a mass. That's all there is to it, just cooking it slowly, 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 stirring for an hour, 2 hours. It took me about 5 hours, actually, but then you end up with a kind of a solid mass, which is a bit like cheese.
Yeah, so spending a few hours stirring, cooking milk, that's a good way to kill time when you're at home.
Yeah, kind of, yes. I had it on a hot plate on my desk, so I was doing my regular work and occasionally looking at it and stirring it up. So
wow, that's impressive. Yeah. Multitasking at a new level.
Yes.
So I gather one of the reasons so is making a comeback right now is because people in Japan are buying more milk than they usually do. Why is that? What's going on?
In late February, the Prime Minister announced that school should be closed down all over the country. And that's what happened the next Monday. So that means that a lot of food producers, including dairy farmers, have a lot of excess milk because they were supplying the school lunch programs. So some of them called out saying, please help us, please consume a bit more milk, especially since you have your children home. And that's what a lot of people did. And because not everyone necessarily likes milk or drinks a lot of it, they had this excess milk on their hands, and stories started to circulate online and so on as how do we use it up? And so is one of the ways that people thought would be interesting. And it kind of was a trend on social media.
I know there is a long history to saw. It was a cheese of prestige at one point. Where does this method of making cheese, making saw, come from?
It's listed in a book which basically lists all kinds of laws and things that could be presented to the emperor. And saw and other dairy products were included in those things. It seems from what we know that it was a very expensive product, kind of like caviar is now, only reserved for the rich, for the aristocrats. And as far as how it was eaten, we don't really know.
And today, Makiko, when you make saw, how do you eat it?
It goes pretty well with salty crackers. It really matches well if you drizzle some honey on it. I actually, because I am a food writer, I have dabbled in making my own cheese and things like that. And to be honest, you know, to make cheese with the proper way, with rennet and things like that, the results are a lot better. So I don't think I will be going into saw production anytime soon.
Makiko Ito is the author of the Jess Bento Cookbook. She's been speaking with us about the cheese saw, which is now trending in Japan. Thank you very much, Makiko. Great to meet you.
Thank you very much.
In these times of lockdown and social distancing, life still goes on. Many of us have turned to apps like Zoom to connect. Here's looking at you, Friday happy hour. But a bunch of friends in Lebanon are communicating in a medium close to my heart.
Basically, Radio Al-Hay started as a project to entertain myself and my friends as we were in isolation.
Majd Al-Shehabi started the radio channel they're calling Radio Al-Hay. Translation, neighborhood radio. Al-Shehabi is an urban planning student living in Beirut. When he and his friends began self-isolating, they thought, let's create something we can all participate in and stream it online. It was an instant hit.
Within a few hours of having it online, a lot of people just reaching out and wanting to just take it on for a few hours, try to drive it for a bit. A lot of people experimenting. That's the first time that they host a radio show, and it's all live, right? So nothing is pre-recorded.
They play some tunes, people come on and recite poetry, read letters. No radio experience required. It's a pretty bare-bones operation, says Al-Shehabi.
Initially, and still right now, actually, it functions a lot like a walkie-talkie. It's just us and our friends listening, right? So it's a little bit of a two-way radio station.
Management at Radio Al-Hay has issued only one directive.
I try to encourage people to not focus their segments about corona, because like if you want to hear about corona, you just go to real life, right?
Yes, you do. An escapist radio station for these times. I love it. Thanks to our friends at the podcast Kerning Cultures for bringing Radio Al-Hay to our attention. It's featured in their latest episode, Lockdown Diaries. One of my favorite releases last year, something that makes me happy every time I hear it, is a collection of old tunes from the French Caribbean islands of Guadeloupe and Martinique. The label Disque Debs International was not well known globally. It was run by a local named Henri Debs. The original recordings were remastered for a first collection, and now a second volume is out showing off the secret gems of these two French territories in the Caribbean. It's called Cadence Revolution, cadence being a dance music from neighboring Haiti that was popular in the 1950s. I just wanted to share one track with you, help you smile on this Friday. The song is Experience by the Guadeloupean band Taboo No. 2. Taboo number two there with that track Experience. Let that be your soundtrack for the weekend. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. We're at theworld.org 24/7 when we're not on the radio, as is our podcast. As always, stay strong, stay safe, and stay healthy. We'll see you back here on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.